Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'll be joined today by Erwin Chemerinsky, constitutional scholar and dean of Berkeley Law. We're recording this interview July 26th. After hosting and producing the show for 17 years, I stepped aside a couple of years ago from recording new live interviews, and since then I've dug into the archives to stream one of the relevant earlier interviews each week on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. And podcasts of years of interviews are available to listen to anytime, anywhere on iTunes, Podomatic, or at my site, aworldthatjustmightwork.com or terrencemcnally.net. They're the same site. But following the election of Donald Trump, I have felt I cannot resist exploring the path forward and confronting him and his administration. First off today, I want to offer you a few websites for information on how to actively participate in resistance to Trump and the movement toward a healthy, progressive future we so desperately need. And you can email me at temcnally@mac.com to get these websites and more. First, indivisibleguide.com, ourrevolution.com, the one that's started by the Bernie Siegel campaign, moveon.org, which has expanded beyond just online organizing to really work with folks on the ground as well, fivecalls.org, which tells you what important calls you might want to make to your representatives, townhallproject.com, which tells you when your local representatives might be having town halls in their districts, and couragecampaign.org, which is active primarily in the state of California. Erwin Chemerinsky became Dean of Berkeley Law just July 1st. From 2008 to 2017, he was the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at UC Irvine School of Law. And prior to that, he was a law professor at Duke University and before that at the University of Southern California. He's the author of more than 200 law review articles and 10 books, including The Case Against the Supreme Court and two books published in 2017, Closing the Courthouse Doors, How Your Constitutional Rights Became Unenforceable, and Free Speech on Campus, written with Howard Gilman. In 2017, National Jurist magazine named him as the most influential person in legal education in the United States. Welcome, Erwin Chemerinsky, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Thank you for the kind introduction. It's really an honor and pleasure to talk with you.
Wonderful. I like folks to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So can you just briefly talk about your path to the work you find yourself doing today? And feel free to mention mentors or turning points, moments of decision along the way.
Sure. I grew up in a working-class family on the south side of Chicago. Neither my parents nor brother or sister ever gone to college. I certainly had mentors who made an enormous difference in my life. I had a high school teacher and high school debate coach who had an enormous impact, and still in touch with him to this day. I went to Northwestern for college, to Harvard for law school. I was inspired to go to law school by the civil rights lawyers of the 1950s and the 1960s. I wanted to be a public interest lawyer. I did that for a short time and then became a law professor in 1980. So I'm about to start my 38th year as a law professor. And I've done it, as you mentioned, in a number of different places, most recently coming here to Berkeley July 1st to be dean and a member of the faculty.
Okay, that move from being the founding dean at Irvine to moving to Berkeley, you'd been in Southern California, counting USC and Irvine, for really most of your career. Why the move at this moment?
I had already publicly said that next year was to be my last year as dean at University of California, Irvine School of Law. Next year would have been my 10th year officially as dean, and it's time for the law school to go through a reexamination. And I'm not the person to lead that reexamination. I've always felt 10 years is the optimal time to be a dean. And the opportunity at Berkeley came along just as I was thinking through the question of, what do I want to do next? This is a terrific law school. It's part of a great university. I can use what I've learned over the last 10 years, but also in a very different context.
Very good. And I want to spend most of our time today on the current issues raised by the Trump administration and the current Supreme Court. But first, could you tell us briefly, just so listeners get a feel for this, about the two books that you published this year?
Sure. One book came out early this year. It's titled Closing the Courthouse Door, How the Supreme Court Has Made Your Constitutional Rights Unenforceable. And the theme here is that over the last couple of decades, in a series of decisions, the Supreme Court has made it ever harder for people who have suffered violations of constitutional rights, even severe injuries, to be able to sue. The Supreme Court has made it harder to sue government and government officials. The court has limited who has standing to sue. The court has made it much harder to sue corporations, enforcing arbitration clauses. And the whole is very troubling. We all learned that if somebody's injured, they should get their day in court. But all too often now, that's a myth. The other book, which is going to be published next month, is about free speech on campus. I co-authored it with the chancellor at the University of California, Irvine, Howard Gilman. And the thesis of this book is what college universities need to do is both protect robust freedom of speech and make sure that campuses are inclusive environments where all students feel safe and protected. And what we try to do is review the history of speech on campus and offer our specific thoughts what campuses can and can't and shouldn't do.
Okay. On that second one, this obviously has been a source of controversy in the last couple of years. Trigger warnings, demonstration, all sorts of things. I can imagine you're trying to thread a needle there. Where do you feel you come down?
Well, we very much discuss exactly the things that you're talking about, things like trigger warnings, safe spaces, the desire to make sure that students are protected and included, but also protect free speech. The bottom line in terms of where we come down is that all ideas and views can be expressed on campus, no matter how offensive, but that campuses can take steps to try to make sure that students have their own opportunity to speech and that students also feel that it's a campus that cares about them and is protecting them.
Very good. Okay, let's turn to the Supreme Court. First of all, how unprecedented, just to remind folks, was the GOP refusal to even consider Obama's selection of Merrick Garland?
It was unprecedented, period. Before 2016, 24 times in American history, there was a vacancy during the last year of a president's term. In 21 of 24, the Senate confirmed. In three instances, the Senate denied confirmation. Never before had the Senate said, no hearings, no vote. Of course, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said that just hours after Justice Scalia died. The Republicans never wavered. This really was a stolen seat, and it's going to have effect for decades to come.
Yeah, I mean, when I look at presidential elections, I think the two most critical things are war and peace and the Supreme Court. You know, there are lots else going on, but those to be the two big ones. How did they get away with this? What does it tell us about the media, the opposition party, public attention? You get where I'm going. I mean, it's something this unprecedented and this critical seemed to not even be a big deal.
They got away with it because the American people were willing to tolerate it, that it's very hard to make the Supreme Court an election issue. You're absolutely right. Who the president puts on the Supreme Court, who the president puts on the lower federal courts, are the most long-lasting legacy of any presidency. Neil Gorsuch is 49 years old.
Oh.
If he remains on the Supreme Court until he's 90, the age was just John Paul Stevens retired. Gorsuch will be Supreme Court Justice for 41 years. That would be until the year 2058. William Rehnquist was appointed by President Richard Nixon in 1971 and served on the court until he passed away in 2005. John Paul Stevens was appointed by Gerald Ford in 1975 and remained on the court until he retired in 2010. Now, you focus on the Supreme Court, and that's what we're talking about, but keep in mind that President Trump is likely to fill a quarter and a third of all the seats on the federal district courts and federal courts of appeals. These are individuals, too, who are going to be there for decades, long after Trump is president.
Yeah, I must say that one of the things I think watching at the chaos in the administration in terms of passing legislation and so on, that I think this is going to be the most important legacy unless something truly tragic happens. Let's talk again. This is a quote about a recent decision and some recent decisions. We're talking here about church and state, and I'm reading from your writing. Never before has the Supreme Court allowed secular corporations to claim religious freedom. People create corporations to protect themselves from liability. By making the corporations a separate entity, the investors are liable only to the extent of their investment. The corporation is an entity that is treated as legally separate from the individuals who run it or own it. And yet, that's not what's happening. This is Hobby Lobby, right? But how big, Irwin, is this going to get? With the court as currently constructed, with the possible addition of another Gorsuch, how far is this going to go?
I think the place where the current court is most likely to dramatically change constitutional law, and it's already happening, is with regard to issues of separation of church and state. On June 26th, just a few weeks ago, the Supreme Court, for the first time in history, found that the government was constitutionally required to provide assistance to religious schools. I think we're now going to see religious institutions suing any time they're denied things that are provided to secular private institutions. A couple of years ago, the Supreme Court said it was constitutional for a city-town board to invite Christian clergy members to all of their meetings over a many-year period to deliver explicitly Christian prayers. You mentioned Hobby Lobby, where the Supreme Court held that a company could refuse to provide contraceptive coverage to women employees because the company's owner's religious beliefs. There's a case before the Supreme Court next term, it'll be argued in the fall, Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission, about whether or not a baker can refuse to make a cake for a gay couple. And I worry that this would then open the door for people being able to discriminate whenever they want by saying it's part of the religious views.
Mm-hmm. And that second case you were talking about was the Trinity Lutheran Church of Columbia versus Comer?
Exactly.
And that's the one where they said that if they were going to if the government was going to subsidize playing fields or parking lots in public schools, they had to be willing to do so for religious schools as well.
And in fact, Chief Justice Roberts concluded by saying, it is odious to deny religious institutions what's provided to secular institutions. Justice Sotomayor wrote a blistering dissent saying, never before in history had the Supreme Court found that the Constitution requires the government to aid to religious institutions. It was long the case that federal governments, state governments, local governments, right, aid to private secular organizations, whether it's for daycare or drug and alcohol rehabilitation. If a religious institution wanted the aid, it would have to create a secular arm. President George W. Bush tried to champion something called charitable choice to allow secular religious institutions to get the same aid as secular institutions. What the Supreme Court now is doing is saying that's a constitutional requirement.
Right. And as you point out, Sandra Day O'Connor, when speaking about this, said, those who would renegotiate the boundaries between church and state must therefore answer a difficult question. Why would you trade a system that has served us so well for one that has served others so poorly? And I'm afraid we're on that trail right now. In another religious legal question here, what's your feeling or your reviews of the Muslim bans and the rulings applied to them?
I think that as virtually every court has ruled, they are unconstitutional. The United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, an opinion by Judge Roger Gregory, said that they're dripping with religious animus. I think it's clear they were motivated by a desire to discriminate on the grounds of religion. The federal court on the West Coast, the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, said that they violate federal law. There's a 1965 immigration statute that specifically says that there cannot be discrimination in immigration policy based on national origin. And that's what the Trump policy does. The Supreme Court is going to hear these cases in October. Three justices, Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch, have already said they're going to uphold the entirety of the travel ban. I think it's going to really come down, as everything does, to Anthony Kennedy, maybe to John Roberts.
Okay. And any thoughts also about the I would say, almost bizarre, but certainly nothing I've seen, I think, in my lifetime, Trump's relationship with the judiciary, belittling them, basically telling people that they will be to blame if there's a successful terror attack.
I think President Trump's attack on the judiciary is unprecedented. Think of the federal district court judge in Washington who found that the Trump travel ban was likely unconstitutional and issued a preliminary injunction. President Trump responded to that by saying he's a so-called judge. When a judge in San Diego was handling the case concerning Trump College, Trump University, President Trump said that he's biased because he's of Latino heritage. When the federal judge in Hawaii issued a preliminary injunction against Travel Ban 2.0, one of Trump's top aides referred to it as a judge out on an island in the Pacific, and forgetting that Hawaii is a part of the United States.
Oh, my God.
My concern is there are relatively few institutions that can check the president. Congress, but this Congress isn't going to do so. The federal courts, the media. And President Trump is so aggressively trying to undermine the credibility, the legitimacy of these institutions. And that's the path to an authoritarian society.
Yeah. In a book that I interviewed you about when it came out, which I was quite impressed with, your book, The Case Against the Supreme Court, you basically said that the Supreme Court, you make the case that throughout its history, the court has overwhelmingly favored corporate power over employees, consumers, the public, has favored government power over individual rights. Talk just a bit about that, and isn't the Roberts Court... with the addition of Gorsuch, with fellows like Alito, about as pro-business as a court could be?
In fact, a study was done, and it was done by people with impeccable credentials, Richard Posner, who's a University of Chicago law professor and a federal court of appeals judge in Chicago, William Landis, an economist at the University of Chicago, and Lee Epstein, professor at Washington University in St. Louis. And they, by a number of different measures, found that the Roberts Court is the most pro-business court that we've had since the mid-1930s. And since then, I think the court has become even more conservative and more pro-business. For the longer term, the real question is going to be, will Justice Kennedy, Justice Ginsburg, Justice Breyer remain until the end of the Trump presidency?
Mm-hmm.
If any one of those three justices leaves the bench between now and January 20th, 2021, that will be a dramatic ideological shift. That will make the court even more pro-business, probably, than it's ever been.
Yeah, one thing that I always notice when there are confirmation hearings and talks about confirmation hearings, people, the media and the public, I think, influenced by the media, seem to talk the most about abortion, gun control, and so on, when in fact, to me, for the last 20 years, it has been the pro-business approach of the court that's the most concerning and really transforms the relationship of citizens to their country.
I think that's right. Just think of Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, which held that corporations have the right to spend from their corporate treasuries unlimited amounts of money to get candidates elected or defeated. Or you mentioned the case of Hobby Lobby, where the Supreme Court for the first time said that corporations have free exercise rights. As you quoted me as saying, corporations are fictional entities. They can't have religious beliefs, and yet the Supreme Court has protected their ability to deny contraceptive coverage to women. I worry they'll next year say that corporations have the right to discriminate based on religion. And these are just a few examples. The Supreme Court has made it so hard to sue generic drug companies, even when the products inflict great injuries. The court has made it almost impossible in many cases for consumers or employees or medical patients to sue because of the court's aggressive enforcement of arbitration clauses.
Okay, and I will just say, by the way, we've mentioned Kennedy, who is 80, and who is perhaps the most likely to retire during Trump's term. He's our swing vote, and the way you prove that he's a swing vote is the last year he voted in the majority 98% of the cases. That indicates he's almost always on the winning side. And yet, for people who look at to him as the hope, he did write the Citizens United decision.
And Kennedy is now 81. He turned that on July 23rd. There are many rumors that he's going to leave the bench. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is 84. Stephen Breyer will turn 79 on August 15th. The question is it realistic that all three of these justices will still be on the court on January 20th, 2021, at the end of the Trump presidency?
Yeah. And of course, with this Congress, we won't see any Merrick Garland refusal to consider. Let's switch to more specifically to Trump. You're co-counsel for the emoluments suit filed by the public interest group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. First of all, remind people, what is an emolument and what does the law forbid?
There are two provisions of the Constitution that are relevant here that use this word emoluments. I think until relatively recently, most people thought an emolument was a skin cream. Article 1, Section 9 says that no person who holds a position of trust in the federal government may receive a present or an emolument from a foreign state. Emolument means benefit. The concern was that foreign governments would exercise too much influence over the new nation. Article 2, Section 1 says the president cannot receive any emoluments from the federal government other than the salary paid for the office. Here the concern was that the president might use the position to benefit personally. The lawsuit says, since taking office on January 20th this year, President Trump has been constantly receiving benefits from foreign states. He's been constantly receiving benefits from the federal government other than the salary that he's paid for the office. And the lawsuit simply says, we want the federal court to declare that what President Trump is doing is unconstitutional and to enjoin him, to force him to comply with the Constitution.
Now, by the way, although we find it outrageous how much is being spent at Mar-a-Lago and on travel and Secret Service for his sons when they go on business trips and so on, it isn't even exactly that, right? In other words, that's sort of an expanded version of what most presidents get. But it's the fact that foreign governments are choosing to stay at Trump hotels as a way potentially of currying favor. It's that kind of thing more specifically, right?
Well, it's all of that. No one can object to Secret Service protection for the president, even though it's expensive. But the problem is when the president is staying at the hotel that he owns, he's then benefiting from every Secret Service agent with government expenses renting a room. So I'm not objecting to the dollars being spent to protect the president. I'm objecting that a good portion of those dollars are going to end up personally benefiting the president. Likewise, with regard to foreign states, there's a great deal of evidence now that foreign governments are renting from Trump properties rather than competitor hotels for just the reason you say, to curry favor with the president. I'll give you an example. Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C., is on the site of the old post office. Donald Trump, in his own name, owns 76% of the interest in this hotel. His children own the others. It's not even a corporation or some kind of front for it. It's just in his name. Every time a foreign government rents space there, Donald Trump is profiting. That violates the Emoluments Clause.
Mm-hmm. And why is no one enforcing this, and what are the methods of enforcing this?
Ultimately, the court has to enforce it. I mean, short of that, it would be Congress impeaching and removing him, and the Republican Congress isn't going to do that, and certainly not about the Emoluments Clause. There are three lawsuits that have been filed against President Trump for violating the Emoluments Clause. There's the one that was filed by Citizens Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, filed on January 23rd. There's a lawsuit that was filed by 200 members of Congress, and there's a separate lawsuit filed by some state attorney generals.
So there's three prongs. All will they end up uniting, or will they be taken up in different courts?
Ultimately, I think this is going to get to the Supreme Court, and I'm not sure there's going to be any mechanism for uniting them until that point. But in the end, the Supreme Court has to decide, will we allow the president to violate the Constitution? I think the most important aspect of the rule of law is that no one, not even the president, is above the law.
Yeah, this particularly is something which seems to chafe Donald Trump, and he points to the fact that the president is not singled out specifically in conflict of interest writings, as if that means he cannot, there is no such thing as a conflict of interest with the president. You contend that's not correct, right?
Well, of course there can be a conflict of interest that applies to the president. Whether a specific statute applies to the president is a different question. But President Trump's statement that says that there's no such thing as a conflict of interest with the president, isn't just another way of trying to say, I'm above the law.
Right.
The law doesn't apply to me. And that just can't be right. So the emoluments clauses that we're talking about are very clear. One says for any person who holds a position of trust in the federal government, surely the President of the United States holds a position of trust. The other says that the President can't do something. Can't be clearer than that, saying the President can't receive any benefits from the federal government other than his salary.
Okay. As I said, we're recording on July 26th, and in my research, I didn't find anything you'd written about impeachment since May 5th. And the headline I saw for that article, is it time to start talking about impeachment? Well, now nearly 12 weeks later, is it?
I think at this stage, the key is for Robert Mueller's investigation to go forward. Mueller is investigating whether President Trump, whether high-level campaign officials, whether high-level government officials violated the law. My great fear, of course, is that President Trump is going to order the firing of Special Prosecutor Mueller. And that in itself, I think, would warrant impeachment investigation. But until then, I think, or until other things happen, we need to see where the criminal investigation goes and what it yields.
And these criminal investigations are notoriously slow. I mean, that's part of, it's almost the nature of them. They are such in-depth investigations. Give some people a sense of how long this might take.
I wish I knew. Mueller has put together a terrific team. If I was to put together the A list of who I would want to investigate this type of matter, that's who Mueller has on his team. The reason I think we need to wait for this is with a Republican House and a Republican Senate, there's no realistic possibility, based on what we know now, that there's going to be impeachment proceedings. But that will all change if it turns out that there's evidence that the president has violated criminal statutes. So rather than expend a lot of energy at this point on something that's going to go nowhere, I would say let the investigation go forward. How long will it take? I don't think any of us know at this point.
Right. And I, by the way, I certainly agree with you that it's almost a distraction to spend a lot of energy and a lot of people's enthusiasm and commitment on something which the Congress is in charge of. And as you say, until there's something that's so clear that even they have to act. What about if there's a crisis, by that intentional or otherwise? I recently interviewed Mark Danner about his book Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War, about the War on Terror. And he makes the point that Obama normalized a lot of what Bush and Cheney had done rather than hold anyone accountable, leaving Trump with a lot of dangerous and many previously illegal options when it comes from responding to terror. What are your thoughts about that, if there were a terror attack or something of that ilk?
My great fear is that if there were a terror attack, President Trump would use it as a basis for claiming authoritarian rule, and he might have supported the country in doing this. If there's another 9/11 or the kind of terrorist attacks that occurred in Europe, I think President Trump's impulse is going to be to try to claim more unchecked power. And we know that in times of crisis, history demonstrates that presidents do this and they're able to get away with it. The Patriot Act was adopted because of 9/11. And I don't know that we've had a president, maybe since Richard Nixon, or Vice President Dick Cheney, who had such authoritarian impulses as Donald Trump. So I'm very worried about that.
Okay. This would be the final question. We've got about a minute and a half here, Irwin. What should people be focusing on? What should people, there's a lot of issues here, and a lot of people, I think, are a little intimidated by you know, legal doctrine and so on. Where should people's eye be for the next few months right now?
Do you remember a book called Future Shock that talked about
absolutely
the problem is so much happening that's greatly troubling, very hard to process it? That's really the Trump administration. I mean, so what do we need to process that we're focused on? We need to focus on, were federal laws violated with regard to Russia's involvement in the 2016 presidential campaign? We need to know. It's about the integrity of the electoral system. It's about the rule of law. Obviously, we all have to focus on health care. It's deeply disturbing that a bill could get adopted that caused 20 million people to lose their health care coverage. We need to focus on what the Trump administration is doing with regard to the environment. I worry because all these other things are dominating the headlines. Not enough focus is being paid to how environmental regulations are being repealed, how everything about climate change has been taken down from federal agency websites, how we have a head of the EPA who denies the very existence of climate change. And these are just the start of the kind of things we need to be focusing on.
Okay, so again, the website is law.berkeley.edu. The most recent books are Closing the Courthouse Doors, How Your Constitutional Rights Became Unenforceable, and Free Speech on Campus, which comes out next week. Thank you, Erwin Chemerinsky. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, and I'd love to do this again.
Okay, very good. We will. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com to the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements of upcoming guests and issues, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at iTunes. Thanks to George Vassilopoulos of Progressive Voices, Mark Maxwell in production, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely.